from the Rabbi's Son. And welcome to our introduction for Parsha number 36, Baha'alacha. Our readings for Baha'alacha start in Numbers 8, verse 1, and proceed through chapter 12, verse 16. Our Haftarah readings will come from Zechariah 2, verse 10, through chapter 4, verse 7. And our Brich HaDashah readings come from 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 1 through 13. Our theme for this parsha will come from Numbers 10, verse 11, where it states, "The cloud lifted." This is our appointed season to spend some quality time with our Bridegroom King, letting Him unveil for us the beautiful mysteries of the 36th parsha of Torah, Baha'alacha. It is in the course of this parsha that the cloud will lift off of Sinai. This is the week during which our Bridegroom will call us out from under the shade of the chuppah and launch us into the deep, dark wilderness. This is our season of glorious departure. Soon we will head off to infinity and beyond. Our spirits will be soaring, our hearts will be overflowing, our minds will be intoxicated with possibilities, and we will be passionately in love with the Bridegroom King. Will it last? Will it endure? Will it overcome the obstacles and transcend the challenges of the wilderness? Perhaps we should not be in such a hurry to leave. After all, first we really need to take care of some unfinished business with the Holy One. As Messiah taught us, sufficient for every day is the evil thereof. We do not yet even know how to greet this new day, much less how to walk in it. Hence, Parsha Baha'alacha will begin with a series of instructions from the Bridegroom on how we in the Camp of the Redeemed are to inaugurate each new interval of daylight. In military camps, a bugler signals the arrival of a new day by blowing reveal, or its equivalent. Not so in the camp of the Holy One's people. In our camp, each period of daylight is inaugurated with the commemoration of the event described in Genesis 1, verse 3, when the voice of the Holy One said, creatively and prophetically, Yehi Or, light be. Aharon is to begin each day by heading straight for the holy place, to the golden menorah, where he is to tend faithfully and adjust as necessary and redirect the light from the seven lamps. The name by which the ancients of our people decreed that this particular parsha of Torah would be remembered is Baha'alacha. It's a mouthful, and I mean that in more ways than one. The Hebrew phrase Baha'alacha is found in Numbers 8, verse 2. There, the Holy One instructs Moshe to begin a new download by saying to his brother Aharon, Baha'alacha et ha'nirot. Unfortunately for Westerners, the phrase Baha'alacha is extremely difficult to translate into English. Hence we find that phrase sometimes translated as when thou lightest, when you arrange, and when you set up. Look closely at the different English verbs the translators have chosen to try to orient the Western reader to the action in which the Holy One wanted Aharon to engage. One is light, as in kindling a fire. Another says arrange, as in organizing. And another says set up, as in assembling. Those verbs conjure up vastly different action images. Which of them, if any, really describes what Aharon is being prophetically called to do? But hold on, I can hear some of you saying, who cares? Why exactly is it important what exactly the Holy One wanted to make sure Moshe told Aharon to do one day several millennia ago? Do you remember the stunning truths we learned back when we were first introduced to the Aaronic priesthood concept? First, we learned that the earthly Mishkan, in which Aharon and his sons functioned as Kohanim, was merely a temporal replica of a spiritual reality far more grand, a spiritual reality that exists eternally in the heavenly courts of the Holy One. We learned, therefore, that the Mishkan actually belonged to two worlds, the world which is seen with human eyes and the world which human eyes cannot see, at least without divine illumination. We learn that each and every detail of the Mishkan the Holy One had our ancestors build on earth, every single furnishing, curtain, sword, silver socket, every single utensil, It was designed to serve as a finite representation of an infinite spiritual reality. And in connection with these truths, we learn that all those the Holy One appointed to serve as priests in the earthly replica of the heavenly reality were likewise only finite representatives of something and someone else, something or someone so much more real, much more holy, and much, much more righteous and much more enduring than Aaron or his sons could ever hope to be. We learn that Aaron is merely the tip of a vast spiritual iceberg. We learn that when we see him doing on earth is just the tip of the iceberg as well. The tip of an iceberg, the primary substance of which is not on earth, in our realm of sight, but is instead in heaven, in the realm of things unseen. In that connection, we then learned what I like to call the law of offsetting spiritual and physical parallels, which is that every action of a man which the Holy One directs to be done in the earthly Mishkan, in the physical realm, corresponds to both an eternal reality related to Messiah in the heavenly Mishkan, in the spiritual realm, and a relation-building truth which each of us is to find a way to represent to the world in real time, in situations in the course of our earthly walk with our Bridegroom King. We learn, therefore, that every time Aharon's name is mentioned in Torah, we're supposed to adjust our spiritual eyes and look right through Aaron as the one who would look through a window pane to the one who he represents, to the risen, ascended, and glorified Messiah. If we understand that all actions of Aaron in relationship to the earthly Mishkan, its furnishings, and its avodah, are intended to be prophetic in nature, pointing us to the role of Messiah as the great high priest of heaven, we must also understand that each and every instruction the Holy One tells Moshe to give to Aharon also directly impacts our role as earthly diplomats of the kingdom of heaven, which Yeshua told us to proclaim was at hand. With these truths in mind, the question of what exactly is Aaron being told to do suddenly looks a whole lot more important and relevant. If we are serious about unlocking the secrets of the introductory phrase for this week's Parsha of Revelation and finding out what this instruction for Aaron has to do with us, it seems we're going to need to go back to the Hebrew. The verb root of the phrase Bahaloka is the Hebrew verb Allah, literally meaning to ascend or to go up high, to arise. Those verbs convey significantly different action images than the English verbs the translators chose: lighting, arranging, and setting up. Try this exercise. As you read Numbers 8, verse 2, instead of picturing Aharon lighting a lamp or arranging or organizing things in the earthly tabernacle, or setting up the menorah so that it would cast light on earth, try to see him ascending and arising. Try to see him actually transcending the earthly realm and entering and performing a function in the kingdom of heaven. Then look through Aharon as you would look through a window pane to Messiah and see the ultimate spiritual reality that the Holy One wants you to see in the realm beyond ordinary human vision. Picture Aharon rising up and going to infinity and beyond. What the divine Bridegroom of Heaven wants you to see is the resurrected ascendant Messiah, high and lifted up, making an appearance on our behalf at the right hand of the throne of the Holy One. Can you see him? Does your heart yearn to be with him? Are you prepared to spend your life doing on earth for others what you see him doing in heaven for you? If you are at least willing to consider that possibility, please permit me to get a little more specific about what that might entail. I explained in the preceding section of this study that the verb at the root of the opening phrase of our Parsha is Allah, and what action images that Hebrew is intended to convey to our minds. But the verb root is only one component part of the phrase we are studying. In the operative phrase, Bahalaka, this verb root happens to be included in a linguistic package. It is preceded by both a preposition and a modifier, and followed by a suffix. Contextually, it is then further followed by another Hebrew phrase, et ha-nerot. What do these things mean? How are we to put all this together? Let's start at the beginning. The bait at the front of the phrase b'chayalacha is a preposition that corresponds to the English word in. The hey that comes next in the phrase is the Hebrew version of the so-called definite article. The ch suffix combination makes the verb second person possessive, much like our English adjective your. Putting all these together with the verb Allah, you get something like in your ascending or in your arising. In the specific context of our parsha, the introductory phrase b'chayalacha is followed by the objective phrase et hanerot. This tells us what Aharon's destination in his arising is to be. Et is a preposition meaning at or upon. Ha, as aforesaid, is akin to the definite article, the. And as we begin this parsha, Aharon is not just to be seen by us as arisen and ascended, but he is to be seen as arising and ascending, and going up or upon or unto the Holy One's ha-nerot. What are nerot? Our English translations equate them to glistening lamps on a lampstand or burning candles in a candelabrum. Whatever they are, they shine, they glisten, they glow. They emanate light. And Aharon, or is that Messiah, is to be seen having ascended and gone up in the midst of them. We can easily understand the earthly picture. Aharon is standing in the holy place just outside the Holy of Holies, right in front of the seven lamps of the golden menorah. But the law of offsetting physical and spiritual parallels tells us that more is happening than meets the eye. Fast forward in your Bibles to Revelation 1:10-20, where Yochanan, sometimes called the Revelator, is speaking of a vision he has had. I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, and I heard behind me a loud voice like a shofar. I turned to see the voice that spoke with me. Having turned, I saw seven gold minarot. And among the minarot was one like the Son of Man, clothed with a robe reaching down to his feet, with a golden sash around his chest. His head and his hair were white as white wool, like snow. His eyes were like a flame of fire. His feet were like burnished brass, as if it had been refined in a furnace. His voice was like the voice of many waters. He had seven stars in his right hand. Out of his mouth proceeded a sharp two-edged sword, and his face was like the sun shining at its brightest. When I saw him, I fell at his feet like a dead man. He laid his right hand on me, saying, "Do not be afraid. I am the first and the last and the living one. I was dead, and behold, I am alive forevermore. Amen. I have the keys of death and of Sheol. Write, therefore, the things that you have seen, and the things that are, and the things which will happen here thereafter. The mystery of the seven stars which you saw in my right hand, and the seven golden minarot. And the seven stars are the angels of the seven assemblies, and the seven minarot are seven assemblies." Are you getting it? On earth, in the earthly Mishkan, there was one menorah holding seven lamps. In heaven, however, the reality after which the menorah and the Mishkan were patterned is vastly greater, deeper, and more wonderful. Indeed, the heavenly reality is exactly sevenfold more wonderful than the earthly replica. The subject of our opening phrase is Aharon, the Holy One's Kohen Gadol on earth. The Holy One is speaking to Aharon about what he is to do each morning upon arising. The Holy One's specific instructions are as follows. In your arising, the lamps, the seven lamps, make them give their light away from the face of the menorah. The Hebraic picture is of Aaron's first action each day. Before doing anything else, he is to cause the flames of and the light from the seven lamps of the menorah that was in the holy place to arise or ascend toward the front. In Leviticus 24, verse 4, the Holy One made clear that Aaron was to be the one responsible for making light emanate from the menorah. Then the Holy One spoke to Moshe, saying, "He shall be in charge of the lamps on the pure gold lampstand before the Holy One, continually." We have looked at the menorah before, when the Holy One showed Moshe the pattern after which the Mishkan and all its furnishings was to be constructed. He made it clear to Moshe that there was to be in the holy place a 7-branched lamp stand made of gold. He also made it clear that the 7 lamps of this lampstand were to be fueled with pure olive oil. And he also let it be known that the care of this light source was to be entrusted to Aharon and his descendants. In Exodus 27, Moshe was instructed, "Instruct the children of Israel that they bring to you pure olive oil, beaten for the light, to cause a lamp to burn continually. In the tent of meeting, outside the veil which is before the testimony, Aaron and his son shall keep it in order, from the evening to morning before the Holy One. It is to be a statute forever throughout their generations on behalf of the children of Israel." The Holy One's instructions to Moshe regarding the specifications for the menorah are given in Exodus 25. The details of its construction are detailed in Exodus 37. The initial lighting of the lamps by Moshe, according to the Holy One's instructions, is described in Exodus 40. Aharon was first instructed concerning his role in regard to this important part of the Mishkan in Leviticus 24. Despite all that prior information being released tidbit by tidbit, however, we are about to find out that the Holy One decided to withhold, perhaps, the most fascinating secret related to the high priest's responsibility in connection with the menorah until today. Aharon did not have to light the menorah each day. Its flame was divine and eternal. The Holy One provided the olives for the fuel mixture. The extraction of oil from those olives was the responsibility of the community. The actual filling of the reservoirs was the task of Aharon's sons. So what exactly was left for Aharon to do regarding the menorah? Aharon's task each morning was merely to adjust and wipe clean the lamps, to clear out any carbon deposits, trim the wicks so as to fine-tune their burning, and to redirect their light. To some degree, the menorah could provide directional lighting. The light produced by the menorah actually came from burning oil in 7 bowls. By slightly adjusting the wick, or the angle at which the bowls set on their support branches, the light of the menorah could be cast in different directions. The holy place was not a large place, and with a little ingenuity, Aharon could, if he wanted, adjust the bowls so as to make every nook and corner of the holy place bright and cheery. If the purpose of the menorah was to provide light for the priest to minister, this would seem like a great idea. This would, however, have one small drawback. It would divert the attention and focus of the priest away from the Holy One and would focus it instead upon the task, assignments, and ministry performed by the priest. So Aharon is told to cause the flames of the menorah to ascend forward, thus casting their light forward. Why, we may ask, forward? And what, we may ask, does forward mean anyway? In Hebraic thought, forward always means toward the presence of the Holy One. A devout Jew always prays facing toward Israel, the Holy One's holy land. If he's in Israel, he always prays facing toward Yerushalayim, the Holy One's holy city. If he's in Yerushalayim, he always prays facing toward the Kotel, or the Western Wall. If he's at the Western Wall, a Jew always prays facing toward where the Holy of Holies once was. Forward means toward the presence of God, in this case toward the veil separating the holy place from the Holy of Holies. What was the effect of directing the flames and light of the menorah forward? It was to backlight the holy place and its furnishings. The priest who functioned there would function in backlit shadows, not brilliant light. Their attention would always be directed and drawn to the one behind the veil, to the Holy One, the source of all light, and who deserved to be the focus of everything that goes on. Let it be with us today, in our families, as the Holy One instructed Moshe that it was to be with Aharon and his sons. Let not the work or the men who do the work be our focus. Instead, let our attention and our longing always be directed toward Him whose presence dwells behind the veil. Let our attention always be captured by the One who sits on the throne and choreographs the work. Let us not seek to have the bright light shine on our ministry, but only on Him. Let us never appropriate unto ourselves any of the glory that belongs to Him. And let us never seek the limelight or the recognition. The limelight's His alone. As a royal bride is trained to glorify her bridegroom king, not her own glory, so we are trained to live and work and serve in the backlight, in order that our bridegroom king may have the limelight he deserves. And if we in our ministries ever become the focus of attention, His glory becomes obscured. So let us make sure we adjust the lamps in the direction of the light each morning before we do anything else, as Messiah taught us. Let us start our mornings with prayers in which we hallow the Holy One's name, and through which we seek first the Holy One's kingdom and the righteousness that comes from Him. Arise and shine, for your light has come. Parsha B'Chayalacha is chock full of action, movement, and emotion. For the first time since Exodus 12, we are actually going to experience a change of scenery. Indeed, by week's end, the camp at Mount Sinai at which we have spent the past 11 glorious months will have disappeared completely in our rearview mirror. In the process of the otherworldly spiritual serenity of Mount Sinai, will quickly be replaced by the extremely challenging physical obstacle course that lies before us in the wilderness. This week's readings will start innocently enough. The Holy One will give a series of instructions to Moshe designed to finally prepare us to break camp. He has determined that we have accomplished all that we are going to accomplish sitting in the shade under the Sinaitic chuppah. The first subject the Holy One will address will have to do with the care of the menorah by the high priest. The Holy One will give specific directions about how He wants the seven lamps of this great lampstand arranged and tended at the start of every day. Next, the Holy One will continue His preparation for the wilderness wandering season. He is designed for us by instructing Moshe specifically as to the kind of relationship He intends for there to be between the Kohanim and the Leviim on the one hand, and the rest of the people in the camp and the Leviim on the other hand. Unbeknownst to Moshe, or the first-time reader, but fully known to the Holy One, conflicts and misunderstandings arising out of this relationship are destined to become a major problem for the camp over the next few weeks. When it happens, the Holy One wants Moshe, Aaron, and the reader prepared for what the divine plan for the relationship consists of, so they will recognize the depth of the problem and its source as soon as it surfaces. The focus of the narrative then turns to calendar issues. As the Holy One gives instructions that, just as the initial journey out of Egypt took place in the aftermath of the observance of Passover, so is the journey away from Sinai predetermined to begin in the aftermath of Passover. After the discussions of Passover observance are reiterated, and the lamb's blood sprinkling imagery is refreshed in the minds of the redeemed, the final preparation for the camp to move will begin. The Holy One will instruct Moshe to fashion two silver trumpets that are to form the camp's new divine communication system. The radiant cloud of the divine presence will then lift. The trumpets will blow, the cloud will begin to move, and the newly reorganized people of the Holy One will follow in perfect divine order, without delaying so much as to utter even a goodbye, Sinai. It's been good to know you. The first march will continue for three straight days. The conditions will turn out to be very, very hot, dry, and arduous. Through the challenges of this environment, the Holy One will test not only the purity of our hearts, but our ability to stay focused on the divine romance in the midst of the heat, sandstorms, exhaustion, suffering, sleep deprivation, and emotional stress. It will not take long for our unredeemed attitudes and appetites to start to surface and take control of our minds and hearts and mouths. Grumbling and murmuring and complaining will start to pour forth from the very same lips that just a few days ago were united in praise and worship and consecration and covenant declarations. Welcome to the flesh and spirit roller coaster. In flesh out moments worthy of a high maintenance shrew instead of the pure and spotless bride we have been called and empowered to be, we will complain about virtually everything. We will complain about the heat of the desert. We will complain about the manna the divine bridegroom gives us to eat. Moshe will throw a temper tantrum to match ours. In response to all this dissatisfaction, the Holy One will allow the establishment of a council of 70 elders will eventually cause further complications with regard to the situation in the camp. The Holy One will send us quail to supplement our diet of manna, but in our state of dissatisfaction and out-of-control appetites, we will abuse the gift with a disgusting display of gluttony. As a result of this gluttonous binge, a horrible plague will break out in the camp, and death will touch our camp for the first time since the golden calf. The toxic atmosphere of dissatisfaction will then strike even Miriam and Aharon, who will judge and speak much evil concerning Moshe. A plague of divine judgment in the form of Za'arat will then break out on Miriam. Moshe will then selflessly intercede for his sister, though she has spoken evil of him, and after an appropriate season of separation from the camp, she will be healed. But do not worry, the Holy One knew all of this ugly junk was in us before he ever betrothed us to him and claimed us as his covenant people. He's not by any means repulsed. His love for us is not by any means diminished. Indeed, he knows that the only way to cleanse us of these hidden, residual, unbride-like characteristics is to bring them to the surface and let us see them for what they are, and let his love and discipline combine to start melting them away. This week we will, in accordance with ancient tradition, supplement the readings from Parsha B'chelecha with related readings from the scroll of the post-exilic prophet Zechariah. Zechariah was from a family of Kohanim, but was born during the Babylonian captivity. He chose to be part of the first wave of the relative few who chose to return to Eretz Yisrael rather than remain in Babylon and Persia, after the decree of Cyrus allowed all Jews to return to the land. It was this first wave of returnees that reestablished the altar of the Holy One at Jerusalem and laid the foundation for the Second Temple, which was later built under the direction of Zerubbabel. Among Zechariah's contemporaries were a prophet named Haggai, a high priest named Yehoshua, and a ruler from the tribe of Yehuda named Zerubbabel. Zechariah's prophecies were often apocalyptic in nature. In the passages we will read this week, Zechariah will describe the fourth and fifth of the eight apocalyptic visions which make up the scroll that bears his name. In these visions, Zechariah will describe both the prophetic plan for the cleansing of the priesthood and the divine plan for the bringing forth light from the menorah through the work of the Ruach, or Spirit of the Holy One. In the passage from the apostolic writings, which I've chosen to correspond with our study of Parsha B'chelecha, Shaul of Tarsus will expand to the primary Gentile Talmudim in this Greek city of Corinth, why reading, studying, and intimately familiarizing ourselves with what the Torah says about the experiences of B'nai Israel in the wilderness is essential to understanding what it is that the Holy One seeks from those in covenant with Him. He will also describe the obstacles and hindrances that lie in the heart of every man that threaten to interfere with our spiritual development and detour us from our great calling, thwart our world-reshaping mission, and hijack our glorious destiny. Shaul will discuss the temptations and natural tendency toward arrogance through which the Holy One tests and develops to maturity the souls of men who walk with Him, whether they be Jew or Gentile. May you stand firm in the midst of testing this week and at all times, beloved. And may you walk worthy of the glorious calling into which you are being inexorably drawn.